It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
I am just having whiplash from all these polls. Yesterday there was a Rasmussen poll that showed Joe Biden up to 45% approval. That up from 39% just a week ago. And last week there was the Bloomberg poll showing Biden tied with Donald Trump in three key states, ahead by 1 point in Wisconsin, which is a statistical tie. And so there was a lot of sighs of relief from the Democrats saying, look, finally, the president getting a little bit of traction. But today, the Wall Street Journal comes out and has Donald Trump leading in 6 out of 7 swing states by 4, 5, 6 points. So you don't know what to believe. Now, look, some of these swing states, Biden has no chance of winning. He's not going to win North Carolina. I don't know if he can win Nevada. But Trump's got a lead in Arizona, in Georgia, another state that I think is out of reach for Biden. Just a 1 point lead there, though. Michigan, Biden down by 3. Pennsylvania, Biden down by 3. Wisconsin, even, 46-46. You know what? If Biden can't win Michigan and Pennsylvania, the election's over. Even more troubling, I think, for the Biden camp in this same journal poll. Who's more trusted to handle certain issues? Economy? Trump by 20. Inflation? Trump by 20. Border security? No mystery there. Trump by 20. Mental fitness for the job? Trump by 20. These are different percentages, but there's a 20-point margin. The war in Ukraine? Trump by about 9. The war in Israel? Trump by 14. Biden is favored on abortion, 45-33, and protecting democracy, but it's a tie, 43-42. And just when we thought, well, the economy is getting a little better and people are starting to recognize it, you know, pick your poison, decide which poll you want to rely on. They're all snapshots. You know, I think polling can be less accurate in the age of cell phones and how many people have landlines anymore. Anyway, George Conway, the ex-husband of Kellyanne Conway, you see him, you know, I don't know, every few hours on MSNBC trashing Donald Trump. He's just donated almost $1 million to a Biden organization. Now, there's no secret as to where George Conway stands, but I don't know. The fact that you're putting in your own money, you know, he's an independent guest, so he has the right to do it. It just makes me feel a little uncomfortable. And one of the things that Conway says is he feels like he has to make amends for supporting Donald Trump in 2016. And he was even up for a possible DOJ job. Then once President Trump took office, you know, you had the whole soap opera where Kellyanne was, you know, one of his most vocal supporters as the White House counselor, and her husband was going on TV trashing her boss, and it ultimately led to the dissolution of their marriage. I don't know if you know the name John Eastman. He was one of these conservative lawyers who actually got involved in 2020 with the then president and the fake electors scheme. And he is a guy who said, you know, we can take this to the Supreme Court. We're probably going to lose. It's probably a Hail Mary, but let's try anyway. Well, yesterday, the state of California disbarred John Eastman. He can't practice law anymore. Judge ruling Eastman's wrongdoing is committed directly in the course and scope of his representation of President Trump and the Trump campaign. Transgressed those ethical limits by advocating, participating, and pursuing a strategy to challenge the results of the 2020 presidential election that lacked evidentiary or legal support. So John Eastman feeling the consequences of what he did. This is interesting. The Daily Caller, conservative website, retracting an article having to do with the all-important matter of the Easter egg hunt, an annual White House tradition. So there was a claim that the Biden White House had banned, quote, religious Easter eggs from the art contest for the egg roll. And the original caller story said the Biden administration banned children from submitting Easter eggs with religious themes. Following publication of this article, the Daily Caller became aware of additional context that undercut the central assertion of this article and its newsworthiness, saying the ban on religious symbolism on eggs as part of the White House Easter egg art contest has been longstanding, dating back decades, and the Biden administration did not make any modifications to this rule. While the caller did not explicitly state that this was new, the additional context rendered the main thrust of the article misleading to readers. We sincerely regret the error. Well, that's a pretty full-throated, and this spread across right-wing media, pretty full-throated retraction for something that's been going on through many administrations, and Joe Biden did nothing to change. All right, let's roll up our sleeves now and dig in. And I want to lead with something, story number one, that happened in Florida. You may have heard, I may have mentioned this yesterday, in fact, that the Florida Supreme Court has upheld Ron DeSantis' signing of the 15-week ban on abortion that in less than 1 month will become a 6-week ban on abortion, which pro-choice advocates say at that point, many women don't even realize that they're pregnant. And so President Biden has weighed in, saying that this new law is outrageous and extreme. Now, did the President of the United States, who obviously is trying to make reproductive rights a key issue, did he go before the cameras and say this? No. He put out a statement. I am just fed up with these statements. Sure, everybody reports the statement. But if you're running for president, get in front of the cameras. You have complete access at any time. Even if you come out and read a 2-minute statement, that's what fuels television. It fuels the web. This illusion that the White House has, if we just put out these written statements, everybody will get the message, is just wrong. Here's Biden's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez. Donald Trump is directly to blame for the fact that abortion has now been effectively banned across the entire southeastern United States. Make no mistake, Donald Trump will do everything in his power to try and enact a national abortion ban if he's reelected. Now, look, there's talk about now Biden can compete in Florida. It's not going to happen. It's a red state. And Trump, I just saw a headline saying he's going to explicitly make his abortion plan public next week. Now, we already know from his interview with me, he was looking at a 16-week ban. Interview a few days later, talking about a 15-week ban. But the point is, this is his second trimester. But I just, as an observer of the process, this is not pro-Biden or anti-Biden, but if he wants to, you know, he's 81 years old. Donald Trump dominates the news every single day. Well, they did put out an ad in which Biden says, Donald Trump doesn't trust women. I do. This will air during Major League Baseball, SNL, Country Music Television Awards. Okay, ads are great. What would be stopping the President of the United States from using his voice, from using his bully pulpit? I think it makes them feel better. Oh, we put out a statement on that. Didn't you get the statement? Meanwhile, the president spoke yesterday with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader. And according to reporting on this, this was supposed to be a check-in call rather than some, you know, big dramatic conversation. But it's the first time they have spoken, I think, in some months. They talked about fighting narcotics, the Middle East, North Korea's nuclear program, China's support of Russia in Ukraine. Now, that's from the official White House summary. John Kirby says they also had a candid and constructive conversation, including such topics as unfair trade policies, wrongfully detained U.S. citizens, and TikTok, which, of course, is owned by a Chinese company. Now, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, is going to China in a few days. Tony Blinken will be going as well afterwards. And, you know, what they're trying to do since the rocky relations in the wake of the Chinese spy balloon episode, Biden wants to show that he can deal with China. I guess the last time they met was outside of San Francisco in November, so that is some months ago. Biden administration has warned China to rein in its Coast Guard ships, which have been firing water cannons at resupply ships in a contested area of the South China Sea, obviously to intimidate Taiwan, which just suffered a terrible earthquake, by the way. But Biden also said that the U.S. will stand by the one China policy, which has been in effect since Richard Nixon's visit to Beijing in 1972. Now, Xi, for his part, said the Taiwan question is the first red line that must not be crossed in China-U.S. relations because they view it as that Taiwan is a breakaway province. They also talked about Biden limiting advanced U.S. technology from getting to China on national security grounds. Biden told Xi that China must not continue to help Russia rebuild its military industrial base. Good luck with that.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Moving on to story two. Donald Trump speaking at a rally yesterday in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Michigan being one of those key states I spoke about earlier. And here he is using the word bloodbath again. Now, you'll remember that there was this huge flap when he used it to talk about the impact on the U.S. auto industry, also having to do with China and tariffs. And a lot of pundits, ignoring the context, said, oh, no, he's talking about if he loses this election, there'll be blood in the streets. So now Trump, you know, who told me that he uses incendiary language as a way of driving news coverage. I've observed this as a feature of how he operates, how he shapes the media agenda for a long time. So now he says the U.S. will face a bloodbath from migrant crime if he's not elected. He said, because if we don't win on November 5th, I think our country is going to cease to exist. It could be the last election we ever have. Interesting bit of jujitsu there, or attempted jujitsu, because obviously President Biden is running against Donald Trump as a danger to democracy. And here he is saying, if I lose, which I think the implication is if he loses, it has to be rigged. And it's certainly what he claims, you know, without evidence, as he and I discussed, after 2020. And he knows bloodbath will get a lot of attention. He's also talked about, because of all the people being let in at the border's a mess, no question about it, huge liability for the Democrats, nobody can deny that. But he said to me, and he said in other interviews, that migrant crime will double. I don't know if that's true. I don't know how many of the people coming across that border are, in fact, coming from mental hospitals and insane asylums or jails. But it's certainly Trump's number one issue. And an issue that strikes a very emotional chord. Now, circling back to this question of polls and the state of the race, here's Jim Garrity in National Review. If you're an incumbent president running like Joe Biden, you definitely want to have a higher job approval rating than 39%. And that's actually a bit higher than it's been in recent weeks. If you're Biden, you would prefer that people rate the state of the economy highly. They do not. And think the country is on the right track instead of heading in the wrong direction. If you're Biden, you'd prefer to be ahead in these head-to-head matchups and national polls with or without such third-party candidates as RFK Jr., Cornel West, Jill Stein. And I don't remember if I said earlier that even when RFK was thrown into the mix in that Wall Street Journal poll, Trump still had a lead of 4, 5, 6 points in some of those key swing states. You'd prefer to consistently lead in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. That's not the case. You can find a good poll for Biden here and there. But a Fox News survey a week ago had Trump ahead in Pennsylvania by 5 points. If you're the Biden campaign, you'd like to see some poll numbers pointing to a chance to pick off a reddish state or two, like Florida, Iowa, North Carolina. Those numbers aren't there. If you're the Biden campaign, I'm sensing a certain pattern here on Jim's part. You're looking for recently competitive states that look pretty secure. You're pretty much limited to Minnesota and New Hampshire. Add it all up, you have a formula for Donald Trump winning more than 270 electoral votes. Can things change? Turn around? Absolutely. But Biden's hopes rely on people who have already rejected him on some level, changing their mind and signing up for another 4 years of his administration. The most widely shared concern is that Biden is just too old for another 4 years in office. An earlier ABC poll found an astounding 86% of Americans think Biden is too old to serve another term. 81% of Americans have positive feelings about Thanksgiving, by comparison. Now, a Biden victory in 2024 will require at least some voters who currently think Biden's too old to get comfortable with Biden's age or with the prospect of Kamala Harris taking over in the near future. People know what they think of Joe Biden. I've made this point. They know what they think of Donald Trump. I am skeptical of the notion that a criminal conviction of Donald Trump will suddenly change the polling numbers dramatically. Certainly the media has been off on this in each of those four criminal cases. But Garrity also says that Trump is among the most polarizing candidates in American history. So really the Democrats' hopes depend on 81-year-old Joe Biden becoming a much better president and candidate than he's been so far. Okay, in the hush money case, the start of which is now 12 days away, Trump had taken flack for criticizing Judge Merchan's daughter, who does work for a firm that supports Democratic candidates. And so I mentioned yesterday the judge expanding his gag order, can't attack people from Judge Merchan's old family, and Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. So what Trump did was he posted a clip from Fox News, quoting legal analyst Jonathan Turley, "The integrity of the New York legal system is at stake here." Turley said that while he opposes the gag order, by the way, "I would prefer that Trump leave these attacks or issues raised with the judge's family to his counsel. I think that's always the better approach." Now, I know it's hard to keep track of all these cases. That's why I, your faithful servant, am doing it for you. So you have the classified documents case, which is not going to end up being heard or completely heard before the election. That's the one in Miami, presided over by a Trump appointee, Aileen Cannon. So Jack Smith, the special prosecutor, special counsel, went at Judge Cannon, saying she was holding up the case with a fundamentally flawed order. You know, what Trump has done is said there are all these unresolved issues and the question of presidential immunity hasn't been addressed. So she seems to be in no hurry. Prosecutors said they could be ready to go by the summer. Jack Smith urged Aileen Cannon to move the case along and make a decision about Trump's claim that he can't be prosecuted for having taken home a bunch of national security documents after leaving office because he transformed them into his own personal property under the Presidential Records Act. That's not based on any facts. The whole reason there is a Presidential Records Act, which dates back to Nixon and Watergate, was to require all presidents, unless they declassify something while in office, they have to treat classified documents as the property of the government that it belongs to the National Archives. All right, moving right along. Story number three. Marjorie Taylor Greene, not exactly backing away from her threat to try to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson. This is a piece in Politico, quoting Greene as saying, I haven't talked to him on the phone one time. But there's more to that. He reached out to me Thursday night before Good Friday, left me a strange voicemail, says MTG, about how he's traveling all over and he's exhausted. And no matter how tired he was, he wanted to try to get on the phone with me. Well, that sounds like an honest outreach effort. And I'm like, why do I want to talk to someone that's so exhausted? That's not good. The speaker texted Green again yesterday, saying he had a busy schedule, but he wanted to chat by today. Green said, well, I have a busy schedule. Let's talk Friday. It's a chat, says Politico, with extremely high stakes for the House GOP majority. Green has vowed to force a vote on ending Johnson's speakership with this motion to vacate, the same maneuver that any single member can bring up that toppled Kevin McCarthy 6 months ago. And if Marjorie Taylor Greene holds off until after April 19th, when another Republican congressman who's resigning rather than just retiring, Mike Gallagher, leaves office, Mike Johnson will only be able to lose one GOP vote, assuming no Democratic support. Now, one House Republican, according to this piece, hinting that he shares Green's frustrations with the speaker, Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie, asking on X, what's your mission, sir? This is in result to Johnson saying on Fox News over the weekend that Marjorie Taylor Greene's ouster threat was a distraction from our mission. But still, nobody has publicly come out and said, we want to get rid of Mike Johnson. Same set of circumstances. Avoid a government shutdown, just like trying to avoid a default. Last spring, the once small Republican majority in the House is now minuscule. So under this plan, if Green follows through, you know, she could reach some accommodation with Johnson. She says she doesn't want to throw the House into chaos. But all it would take would be one more vote, and he'd be out. And then we'd be back to another round of who's going to be speaker, Could it be Jim Jordan? Well, he didn't get it. Could it be Steve Scalise? Well, he didn't get it. So one of the things that's coming up is this foreign aid bill, where, as I mentioned to those who faithfully listen to this podcast, that Mike Johnson wants to arrange for aid to Ukraine, and he wants to trade it for pork, namely lifting a Biden moratorium on liquefied natural gas, which also just happens to benefit a facility in Johnson's Louisiana district. You know what? That's congressional horse trading. Since it doesn't involve the border, which is so toxic, and which Donald Trump has gotten the House Republicans to back off of any compromise there, well, this might be a way to deal with it. But again, it's supposed to take weeks. Zelensky has just lowered the draft age in order to get more conscripts into his army. Things are desperate. And speaking of war in the Middle East and desperation, I still just am grieving, cannot get over the unbelievably stupid attack by the Israeli military that killed seven of Jose Andres' food workers. If Israel was trying to turn world opinion against its country, it couldn't be doing a better job than right now. And President Biden is reported to have called Jose Andre and express his grave concern.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Story four, I've told you since Monday my feelings about the incredible Caitlin Clark virtually single-handedly leading her Iowa team to a win over LSU, putting them into the Final Four. But a lot of other people have been weighing in now, and I want to share some of that with you. First of all, the ratings. And without even knowing what the numbers would be, I just said, most watched women's basketball game of all time. Well, the game averaged 12 million viewers and peaked at 16 million. Now, that surpasses the previous record of last year's championship game when LSU beat Iowa. That was 9.9. So these are phenomenal numbers. Now, there's an LA Times columnist named Ben Bolch, who has now had his piece removed by the newspaper with an apology. He described the matchup between LSU and UCLA as a good versus evil contest and referred to the LSU team as dirty debutantes. Do you prefer America's Sweethearts or its dirty debutantes? Milk and cookies or Louisiana hot sauce? Careful research by me reveals that Dirty Debutantes is also the name of a porn film, something I would not otherwise know. So this was talked about on CNN, and veteran sports writer Christine Brennan, an old friend of mine, said, you know, I was moderating a panel a week ago. I asked all the panelists, if Caitlin Clark were black, would we be looking at her and looking at this in a different way? And let's be honest, the answer from everyone on the panel was yes, in some way or another. And of course, race is part of our lives. And I think the idea that what has happened with Angel Reese, she is the best player on the LSU team, who's taken a lot of criticism and actually was wiping away tears, even though she gave this little speech about how she's tough and she doesn't regret taunting Caitlin Clark in last year's championship game. And she said, I'm just going to be me, not going to change the way I do things. But then, as I said, she was wiping away tears. And she talked about, with a clear racial undertone, how difficult it has been for her. This is the worst of journalism, says Christine Brennan, as practiced by the Los Angeles Times. So, in terms of Angel Reese, who ended up fouling out of that game on Monday. Dave Portnoy from the sports site Barstool called her a classless piece of S. And she said, I've been through so much. I've seen so much. I've been attacked so many times, death threats. I've been sexualized. I've been threatened. I've been so many things. And I've stood strong every single time. I just try to stand strong for my teammates. And this Iowa team is so hot that Jason Sudeikis showed up at the game on Monday. You know, Ted Lasso. And he had a gray hoodie that said, everyone watches women's sports. And some of the people who were quoted in this Washington Post story, I'm glad more people like women's basketball because they used to S on it, said one Iowa fan. When a sport explodes in popularity, as women's college basketball has over the past year, the gatekeepers can't always protect their game from the downside of growth. And it talks about Angel Reese, how she was wearing a tiara on the court when she came out. But she might have chosen to wear a target. She's being described as a Bayou Barbie, which is obviously not the most flattering term I've ever heard. And finally, on this subject, the LSU women's basketball coach, Kim Mulkey, hit with a huge backlash because she took her team off the court after they came out and did a shoot around before the national anthem. So they're off the court, and the only team standing for the national anthem is Caitlin Clark's Iowa team. And there's a lot of abuse online against the LSU Tigers. One person saying, I don't want to hear anybody out. This is flat out embarrassing. Some called them terrorists. Some said the players hated America. Now, a reporter who's covered the team for 3 years said the Tigers are never on the court during the anthem. Now, Mulkey was asked about this, and she says, and I'm sorry, I'm just not buying this. Honestly, I don't even know when the anthem was played. We kind of have a routine. We're on the floor, and then they come off at 12-minute mark. I don't know. We come in and do our pregame stuff. I'm sorry. Listen, nothing was intentionally done. Okay, she is not a dumb woman. She has to know this was going to be the most watched women's basketball game of all time, that there is a national anthem coming up. Why bring that sort of abuse on your team and then say, oh, you know, this is what we always do. It's just, you know, it has nothing to do with anything. I'm sorry. That is an unforced error, as they say in sports. And story number five, the first part of this will please some people, perhaps many people in New York. The state legislature is in the process of repealing a law that's been around for, I don't know, 100 years or something, against adultery. There's a few states in which adultery is still illegal. I don't think many people get prosecuted for it. And New York is one of them. And apparently, that's going to change. But here is a piece about San Francisco. So few places have done more than the Bay Area, says this Times piece, to ensure that bosses can call, text, or Slack their workers all the time, nights, weekends, you name it. But a San Francisco lawmaker wants to help curb the constant ringing and pinging as his region helped create. New legislation would make his state the first in the country to give employees the legal right to hit the ignore button on their phones when the boss calls after hours. Emails, texts, other work communication could also be put off until you're back on the clock. This apparently was first done in Australia. Oh, but it's also been adopted, or versions of it, in France, Canada, Italy, Belgium, Philippines. People now find themselves always on and never off, says this Assemblyman Matt Haney. There's an availability creep that has reached into many people's lives. And I think it's not a positive thing for people's happiness for their well-being or even for work productivity. Now, this would require public and private employers to establish, I don't think this is going to pass, but who knows, it's San Francisco, establish a policy granting workers the right to ignore off-hour communications from their bosses except in case of emergency or for scheduling changes affecting the next 24 hours. Teachers, nurses, other unionized workers would be covered by whatever their contracts say. This lawmaker says it's not intended to say people can't work long hours or have an agreement for a contract when they're on call, but it should be made clear. But the head of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce says employees are already enjoying a better work-life balance than they did before the pandemic. They can spend time with their children in the afternoon, return to the laptop later at night. Not everybody wants a 9-to-5 schedule. And this guy says there's a do not disturb feature on most phones. Just because it rings doesn't mean you have to pick up. And this is my thought. This is dumb. This is stupid. Now, unless your boss is abusive and isn't calling you until midnight, it is true. Schedules are much more flexible. There's more hybrid. People are working at home. They can leave and pick up their kids from school and push some work till the nighttime. Do you want to be known as the person who's always unavailable after 6 p.m.? The pandemic changed all of our thinking about this. And I agree, you'd rather have some work-life balance than have a rigid set of rules. And this is like, oh, boss is calling? Hell with you. I'm not picking it up. Now, if you're in the middle of something, you could call back. You could text back. I just think this is government overreach. But we'll see if it gets anywhere in the People's Republic of San Francisco. Hey, thanks for listening as we bounce around the media landscape here. Back here tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.